So good evening, and thank you for being here, and thank you, Professor Anderson, for the very kind introduction. Now, my presentation is on the idea of no self in Confucian thought, and I will comment on four Confucian thinkers, and they are Confucius, Mencius, Zhu Xi, Wang Yangming. The later Confucians Zhu Xi and Wang Yangming are often referred to as Neo-Confucians in English. But before saying more about their background, I will illustrate the idea of no self with four quotes. According to Zhu Xi, the sage reaches a state of no self after undertaking a process of self-transformation to its limit. That's number one. He is explicit that this state of no self does not mean that one cannot distinguish between oneself and others. That's number two. Rather, his point is that one does not draw a distinction of a certain kind between oneself and others, which he refers to as a form of self-centeredness. Wang Yangming makes similar observations. He presents the state of no self as the basis of the learning of the sage, number three. Again, for him, this means that there is no distinction of significance or no separation between oneself and others, number four. The idea of no self is not a claim about what does not exist. It is not the claim that there is no such thing as a self, where the self is understood in a certain way. Instead, the Chinese expression, translated as no self, makes use of first personal pronouns. Translated literally, it would become no me, no myself. That is, the idea of no self is a claim about how I should transform myself so that there is no distinction of significance between myself and others. As we saw, someone in that state still retains an ordinary distinction between oneself and others. Also, as is commonly known, Confucian thinkers place an emphasis on social relations. We should interact in different ways with others, depending on their different relations to us. So the state of no self does not exclude this kind of differential interactions. What it excludes is any further distinction of significance between oneself and others that goes beyond the ordinary distinction and this kind of differential interaction. For convenience, I will say that the state of no self excludes the presence of an emphatic self. For the Confucians, this emphatic self results from my relating to my own psychological state in a certain problematic way. Consider, for example, this statement by Wang Yangming. According to him, the sage responds in whatever way is appropriate to a situation, in the way that a clear mirror responds with an image that matches an object. The sage does not add anything to the response, and so, in a sense, the response does not come from him. In this sense, the sage's emotions follow the 10,000 affairs, and he has no emotions of his own. Here, the term translated as emotions has a broader scope than the English word emotions. It refers to our psychological responses to situations we encounter, including not just what we would call emotions, but also such responses as liking or disliking something or wanting to go after something. He also comments that our emotions should follow their natural causes of operation, but there should not be any attachment. Here, the term translated as attachment has the connotation of holding on to something and not letting go. The point is that we should relate to our own psychological state in a way that is free from attachment. For convenience, I will refer to this as a state of detachment. So the Confucian idea of no self has two dimensions. First, we do not place any special significance on ourselves by comparison to others, going beyond the ordinary distinction and differential interactions. Second, we are detached from, not attached to, our own psychological state. Before exploring these two dimensions further, I will say something about my approach to the philosophical study of Chinese thought. By the philosophical study of Chinese thought, I mean a study that brings out its contemporary relevance and builds a linkage to contemporary Western philosophical discourse. The approach I adopt has evolved over the years, initially taking one step, and then two, and then three. There is a straightforward way of building a linkage to contemporary philosophical discourse. We look at Chinese thought in terms of contemporary philosophical agendas, asking how it addresses such questions as why be moral, or how is the weakness of the will possible? And we try to fit its ideas into contemporary philosophical frameworks, such as virtue ethics and consequentialism. But there is a danger to this one-step approach. The primary concerns of the Chinese thinkers are very different from our own philosophical concerns, and their conceptual apparatus also very different from ours. By looking at their ideas in terms of our own familiar philosophical conceptions, our habits of thought might distort our understanding of their perspectives. This consideration suggests a two-step approach. As the first step, we try to approximate the perspectives of the Chinese thinkers. We carefully study the language, analyze the text in detail, and take into account the historical context, including their life histories. This is the task of philology, understood in a broad sense. As a second step, we undertake further reflective work with these ideas, showing how they relate to contemporary philosophical discourse. This is the task of philosophy. But there is still a missing step. The problem is that the philological work by itself does not tell us how to make the transition to the philosophical study. It provides us with a body of ideas that appear alien to us, presented through conceptual apparatus radically different from ours. If we frame these ideas in terms of contemporary philosophical conceptions, we again distort the perspectives of these thinkers. What we need is a way to truly understand the significance of their ideas and present this in ordinary plain language. There is the additional task of moving from philology to philosophy. For this purpose, we need to find common ground between their perspectives and ours. Chinese thinkers are deeply ethical in their concerns, and their ideas reflect their own ethical experience. To grasp the significance of their ideas, we need to understand their ideas in relation to their experience, and then relate these ideas to our own experiences that are akin to theirs. The common ground lies with certain human experiences of significance that are shared across cultures and times. This consideration suggests a three-step approach that proceeds from the inside out. We first engage in philological study to approximate their perspectives, and then seek common ground in their life experiences that transcend the local and the temporal, and then relate their ideas to contemporary philosophical discourse. The goal is to ensure maximal continuity between their perspectives and the philosophical work we undertake with their ideas. And this is the approach I have adopted. And this presentation is a summary of the more philosophical work. I will start with some comments on the historical background. Confucius and Mencius lived in the Warring States period with persistent warfare between states and also political rivalries within individual states. Confucius traveled among the states trying to convince rulers to practice an ethical ideal that emphasized moral cultivation and social harmony. The rulers were not responsive, and he was often obstructed and slandered by powerful officials. After repeated failures, he turned his focus to teaching to prepare for the next generation for similar efforts. Mencius saw himself as a follower of Confucius, engaged in similar endeavors, and was equally unsuccessful. Zhu Xi and Wang Yangming lived in times when there was a single imperial government. Zhu Xi did not occupy any major office in court, but even as a local official, he repeatedly petitioned the emperor for change. Wang Yangming had a more active role in court and once successfully crushed a rebellion. Both were outspoken against corruption and abuses of power, made enemies in court, and were slandered and persecuted. Zhu Xi was on one occasion almost executed. Wang Yangming experienced the humiliation of being beaten with 40 strokes and then exiled. These thinkers developed their ideas on the basis of this kind of life experiences. What unites them is a shared ethical and political ideal referred to as the way, and a sense of mission to spread the way. This involves personally embodying the ethical ideal, active political involvement to put it into practice, and also teaching students to do the same. Their concerns are primarily practical, unlike present-day academics. The idea of no self reflects certain features of their life experiences, and I will consider some examples. As a start, consider Zhu Xi's and Wang Yangming's experience in court. They confront deep hostilities, but there is no opting out. Their only venue for reform is through the central government, unlike Confucius and Mencius, who could travel to another state. For them, the question is how to cope with the persistent personal injuries that they have to endure. They would respond with anger, but the question is, what form should this anger take? Consider a situation in which an offender has wrongfully injured a victim, the two not being closely related. If the victim is a stranger, I might respond with anger at the situation because I care about the ethical norms that have been violated, and perhaps also because I care about the victim as a fellow human. I might be moved to intervene or take corrective steps. If the victim is related to me in a special way, say a friend or a student, I might respond with greater emotional intensity because I care about the victim in a special way. I might also feel a greater urgency and also a special obligation to intervene. This is a matter of differential response due to the different relations the victim stands to me, something that the Confucians and we ourselves would endorse. If the victim is me myself, I might, for the same reason, respond with greater emotional intensity and feel a greater urgency to defend myself, to the extent that the nature of my response is not different from the other two scenarios. This is again a matter of differential response. My attention is still focused primarily on the problematic situation and on the proper way to respond to the situation. But my response when I myself am the victim might take a different form. When personally injured, a common human tendency is to focus on ourselves as victims. I place a special significance on the way I myself am treated by others, and I regard wrongful injury of myself as a personal challenge, affecting my standing as a person. My attention is focused on the offender as someone who poses this challenge. In this way, my anger in response to personal injury can take two different forms. In the first case, my attention is focused primarily on the situation and on how to properly respond to the situation. In the second case, my attention is focused on the offender as someone who has personally challenged me and on how to counter this challenge. In the first case, my anger is directed at the situation. I'm angry at what has been done. In the second case, my anger is directed at the offender. I am angry at him for doing this to me. The Confucians idolized the first form of anger. Zhu Zi describes the two forms of anger as anger that pertains to morality and anger that pertains to the physical body, and regards the former as a higher form of anger. This view is representative of the Confucian position. The Confucians are explicit that our sense of honor and disgrace should not be a matter of how we are treated by others. Instead, it should be a matter of our own ethical qualities, including our own ethical conduct. When confronting wrongful injury, what is of primary importance is to respond to the ethically problematic situation in a way that is ethically appropriate. My attention should be focused on the situation and on how to appropriately respond to the situation. It should not be focused on the offender and on how to counter the personal challenge posed by the offender. And to reflect this difference, Zhu Zi also describes the first form of anger as residing in things, and the second as residing in oneself. In making this proposal, the Confucians do not deny that human beings do tend to assign special significance to themselves and to respond with the second form of anger. Their view of what is truly disgraceful is directed exactly against this tendency to view what is disgraceful in terms of how one is treated by others. To respond with this form of anger is for them to overemphasize ourselves. Their proposal is that we should move away from emphasizing ourselves in this way, so that we respond to wrongful injury of ourselves in the way we would to wrongful injury of someone else. We still recognize that it is ourselves, not someone else, who has been injured. But this fact is no longer emphasized. In short, there is no emphatic self. To have an emphatic self is to take up a viewpoint from which I myself carry a special significance that I do not assign to others. In connection with wrongful injury, this viewpoint derives from the tendency to overemphasize myself by assigning a special significance to the way I am treated by others. The Confucian view on anger is directed against this tendency. But the special significance we assign to ourselves can also derive from a tendency to underemphasize others by not assigning to them a significance comparable to that we assign to ourselves. This happens when we are not sufficiently sensitive to harm to others, and the Confucian idea of one body is directed against this tendency. For this discussion, I will assume the notion of well-being of humans and refer to as harm any occurrence that is detrimental to someone's well-being. Our focus is the Confucian position on how to respond to harm to others. In the literature, the Confucian position is often presented in terms of contemporary philosophical conceptions. For example, consider this remark by Mencius. Some have argued that the response described by Mencius is one of sympathy. This is supposed to involve our taking up a third-person perspective on the imminent harm to the child and our being moved by a positive regard for the child. Or consider the Confucian idea that we should form one body with all things. That's quote number two. Wang Yangming speaks of all things being part of his body in that he views the pain of others in a way comparable to pain in his own body. And some have argued that this idea of one body should be understood in terms of empathy. This is supposed to involve our imaginatively projecting ourselves into the perspective of the other, experiencing things from his perspective. But an analysis of the language points to a different understanding of the Confucian position. In the remark by Mencius, the terms translated as sensitive to the suffering of others and as compassion refers to responses of the heart that are directed to situations, not the objects of harm, that are directed to situations that involve harm. The responses involved a sense of alarm, pain and distress, and being unable to bear the situation. Also, these terms can describe one's response to situations involving harm to oneself, not just harm to others. And further historical research shows that the idea of one body is modeled on the parent-child relationship. An early text describes how parent and child are connected like a single body divided into two, quote number three. The emphasis is on the sense of connectedness between the two. This is illustrated by how the parent would be moved by harm to her child in an unmediated and intimate fashion in a way comparable to her response to harm to herself. The Confucians emphasize how we would respond in this manner to harm to ourselves as well as to harm to another who stands in a close relationship to us, such as in the parent-child relationship. We also respond in this manner if the harm is presented in a vivid fashion, as when we visually witness the young child about to fall into a well. In addition, they highlight this kind of response in the context of special accountability by virtue of one's official position. For example, Mencius describes how an official charged with regulating the waters to prevent flooding would look upon anyone who drowned from flooding as if he himself had drowned the person. A contemporary example is the pain a school principal would feel when she learns that dozens of her students have been buried alive in an earthquake. But we can't become indifferent in the absence of these special considerations. We might be indifferent to harm to total strangers, apparently unrelated to us. We might be indifferent to famine victims in faraway lands until we see graphic images of their plight on TV. And we might be indifferent to efforts at environmental conservation because we do not see ourselves as accountable to future human generations. What the ideal of one body advocates is that we sensitize our heart to mitigate the various factors that might limit the scope of its sensitivity. This is something we do in the education of children, as when we bring them to a developing country to have more direct exposure to a life of deprivation. Ideally, we should respond with similar intimacy to situations involving harm to any, taking into account the differential responses due to different relations. When a parent becomes aware of serious harm to her child, she responds in the way that she would to comparable harm to herself. From her perspective, she and her child are not distinct in any sense, going beyond the ordinary distinction between individuals. She sees herself and her child as connected. It is as if they are one body spatially divided into two. The idea of connectedness is fundamental to the idea of one body, which advocates that we view all other humans as similarly connected to ourselves. The point is conveyed in an early Confucian text by saying that the sage views all the human community as a single family. In the case of wrongful injury, is the tendency to ascribe special significance to the way we are treated by others that generates an emphatic self. The remedy is to transform ourselves so that we respond to wrongful injury to ourselves in a way comparable to our response to wrongful injury of others. By contrast, in the case of our response to harm, it is the tendency to ascribe insufficient significance to harm to others due to these limiting factors that generate an emphatic self. The remedy is to sensitize our heart so that we respond to harm to others in a way comparable to our response to harm to ourselves. I have used two examples to illustrate the first dimension of the idea of no self, which concerns the way we relate to others. I now turn to the second dimension, which concerns the way we relate to our own psychological states. Juicy describes in four steps how the emphatic self emerges. Starting with some innocent desire, like and dislike, we magnify their significance by having thought of putting in special effort to bring about or prevent certain situations. We then form anticipation of the outcomes with fixated attention. When the outcomes go in accordance with or against our wishes, we do not just respond emotionally to them, but also dwell on the responses and also on the outcomes. This leads to the emergence of what he calls the self-centered self. And this, in turn, leads us to further magnify the significance of the initial desire, and the whole process repeats over time, further solidifying the self-centered self. This kind of phenomena is familiar to us. For example, we tend to be pleased at being well regarded by others. But I might magnify the significance of this by having thought of deliberately making a favorable impression at an upcoming presentation. As I attend the event, I'm moved to speak in a certain manner to impress. I form the anticipation of making a favorable impression, and my attention becomes fixated as I eagerly look for signs of a positive response. I might even subtly induce my colleagues to talk about my performance. Now, I not only feel pleased if I succeed and displeased if not, but I dwell on these responses. They then fit into the formation of a vain and conceited self, a conception of myself as superior, as deserving of attention. And as such a self emerge, it generates other thought that further magnifies my sense of importance. I might, for example, have thought of criticizing others for the purpose of displaying my supposed superiority. This process accounts for what Wang Yangming refers to as attachment. I become attached to the pleasure of being well regarded and also to the praise and recognition, in the sense that my attention constantly shifts back to it. And in responding in this way, I have injected myself into my responses. And in doing so, my mind is also pulled along by my responses. I not only respond with disappointment if my presentation is not well received, my attention repeatedly shifts back to that experience and my mind becomes disturbed. The state of detachment as opposed to attachment is illustrated by Zhu Xi in his further comments on anger. We all prefer not to be mistreated, but I might magnify the significance and regard the way I'm treated by others as tied to my sense of honor and disgrace. As a result, when wrongfully injured, I focus on the wrongful injury as a personal challenge. This intrusion of the emphatic self is like dust that gathers on a mirror, adversely affecting my response. Ideally, the mind should be like a clear mirror. Its response of anger should be focused on the situation, not on myself. The anger follows the situation, that is, it takes a form made appropriate by the situation, in the way that the image in a clear mirror accurately reflects the object. The mind should be like a mirror reflecting things. It just follows things and responds, number one. The metaphor of clear mirror has another implication. If I take wrongful injury personally, there is a tendency for my anger to persist even after the situation has been corrected. I might still bear a grudge against the offender. But if my anger is directed at the situation, it dissipates after the situation has been corrected and there is no residue, number two. Furthermore, just as the image in a mirror is called forth by the object, my anger is called forth by the situation. Although the anger is still my anger in an ordinary sense, it is not my anger in that I have not injected myself into the response. In this sense, number three, the sage does not have anger. And finally, another effect of viewing wrongful injury as a personal challenge is that my mind becomes agitated. It is as if I have lost control over my mind so that it is pulled along by what happens to me. By contrast, if my anger is focused on the situation, the mind will, in Wang Yangming's word, stay broad and unperturbed. Number four. Juicy uses the metaphor of still water to highlight this last point. Still water can act as a clear mirror, but the metaphor makes the additional point that the mind is free from disturbance. These comments on anger illustrate the two aspects of the state of detachment. The mind does not inject itself into the response, so that the anger is just a reflection of the situation. As a result, the anger does not disturb my peace of mind. We noted earlier Wang Yangming's comment that the sage's emotions follow the 10,000 affairs and he has no emotions of his own. His comment generalizes this point to our responses to situations in general. When in the state of detachment, it is as if the mind operates at two different levels. There are the first order, more immediate responses to our environment, including emotional responses of all kind. At the same time, the mind maintains a more enduring second order posture, in which it stays anchored, calm, unperturbed in the midst of the first order responses. Having illustrated the idea of detachment with the example of anger, I will consider another example, our response to loss, to hardship, and to failure. I will refer to the response that the Confucians idolize as one of acceptance, something that Confucius and Mencius highlight. The comments by Juicy and Wang Yangming on anger reflect their own experiences with repeated personal injuries as they sought reform through the central government. By contrast, Confucius and Mencius, they had the option of leaving a state in face of obstruction and moving to another in hope of better success. For them, the question is how to confront the persistent failure of their own effort, as well as the deprivation and loss that they faced. They used the term Ming, often translated as fate or destiny, to refer to adverse conditions of life that one cannot change. These can be things that we literally cannot change, such as death from starvation when no food is available. They can be things that we normatively cannot change, such as death from starvation, when the only way of obtaining food is by killing someone. Using the term, they convey an attitude of acceptance in response to such conditions. Just like anger in response to personal injury, acceptance has to do with the way our attention is directed. In acceptance, we still acknowledge the genuine loss and respond with sorrow and frustration. But we do not fixate attention on the loss and the emotional suffering, and instead direct attention proactively to other matters of importance. The Annals of Confucius contains several examples of this attitude. In face of material deprivation, one should focus attention on the way, number one. And when not appreciated by others, one should direct attention to one's own qualities to make oneself worthy of appreciation, number two. When confronting hardship or persistent failure, it is tempting to translate this sense of loss into a sense of injustice. As a result, one becomes bitter and resentful. Acceptance also involves being free from this tendency. Confucius comments on the importance of not taking offense when not appreciated by others, number three. Confronting persistent failure in his own political endeavors, he himself would not put the blame on others, nor feel resentful against the world at large, number four. Of the losses in life, the most difficult to accept is one's own death. To see what accepting death involves, let us consider two scenarios involving a scientist. After years of dedicated work, she is just 1 year away from discovering a cure for a so far incurable disease. But to her shock, she is herself diagnosed with terminal illness and has only 1 month left. What she regards as important in her scientific endeavors affects how she directs her attention and responds to her imminent death. She herself might figure in a prominent way. What carries primary importance is not the scientific discovery as such, nor the human benefit it brings, but herself making the discovery along with the resulting honor and recognition. From such a perspective, her attention will be fixated on her imminent death. She bitterly questions why this should happen to her, with a sense of being unfairly deprived of a place in history. She is overwhelmed by her emotions and is unable to do anything constructive with her remaining time. In the extreme case, she might even resort to destroying records of her progress so that no one can steal her accomplishment. By contrast, what is of primary importance might be the scientific breakthrough and its benefit to the human community as such. She is still pleased by any honor it brings, but is still saddened that she cannot see her research to its conclusion. She does see her death as a genuine loss and feels its psychological impact. But her attention is not fixated on herself, and she maintains a distance from her loss and suffering to proactively respond to the situation. She would gather her associates and pass on the progress she has made so that the research can be concluded after her death. She would spend time with family and make amendments to anyone whom she believes she has not treated well. The two scientists share similar responses natural to humans: pleasure at being recognized and sorrow at one's own imminent death. Unlike the first, who is more personally involved, the second stands some distance from her approaching death. In accepting an adversity, the mind stands apart from the loss and the emotional suffering and stays anchored and unperturbed in the midst of these responses. This provides another illustration of the state of detachment. Whether we can accept death when the time comes depends on what we regard as important in our lives, which affect the way we structure our lives. So the idea of acceptance concerns not just an attitude that we take up when confronting adversities in life. It also has to do with a more enduring outlook in life that prepares us to accept such adversities. Acceptance as an outlook needs to be cultivated over time. Confucius presents this outlook in terms of understanding Ming, a characteristic of the morally superior person, number one. Here, Mencius speaks of cultivating oneself to await the adversities of life so that one can stand firm on one's purpose, even in the face of death, number two. And here, awaiting Ming includes awaiting one's own death, which involves the awareness that death can come at any time. It is not just death, but its timing that is outside our control. Mencius also speaks of flowing along with and willingly accepting proper Ming, number three. The idea that we should accept only proper Ming has a broader significance. Namely, in preparing for our own eventual death, we should ensure that we live a life of such a kind that when death finally comes, and at any time it comes, we will have nothing to regret upon looking back. Having talked about acceptance as another illustration of the state of detachment, I now return to the idea of no self. There are several other aspects of the idea that we have not discussed, but I will make just one final observation. I just described acceptance as an outlook in life. The term outlook emphasizes the fact that acceptance involves a way of looking at adversities in life and one's relation to them. The same can be said of the idealized form of anger. It involves looking at injury to oneself in a way that does not carry any special significance compared to injury to others. This point is true of the state of no self in general. It is fundamentally a way of looking at the world and one's place in it, in short, an ethical outlook. As an ethical outlook, the state of no self is not primarily a matter of beliefs, although it might involve certain beliefs. Consider someone who comes to accept her death after initially struggling against it. She does so not by coming to know more about her situation, but by viewing what she already knows in a different light. In her conversion to the new outlook, her beliefs will have changed, such as her beliefs about what is important and what she needs to do with her remaining time. But this change is part of what is involved in her coming to accept her death and does not explain the conversion. She could have acquired similar beliefs through discussion with friends, but still not accept her death. For this reason, the Confucians describe the ideal state of the mind using a perceptual term. The term can be translated as brightness, clarity. It describes the brightness of the sun and moon, as well as the eyes, clarity of sight. When transitioning to this state and from the perspective of someone in this state, one has come to see things clearly. Things have come to be illuminated. Not everything we have said about the state of no self is part of the content of this ethical outlook in the sense of describing the perspective of someone in that state. Juicy distinguishes between two perspectives on the state of no self. The internal perspective is the perspective that someone in that state has by virtue of being in that state. The external perspective is the perspective that an observer takes up in describing her state. Not everything we say about her state from the external perspective need be part of her internal perspective. The point is familiar to us. Not everything in our description of the virtuous person need be part of her own self-description. So a further distinction can be drawn within our description from the external perspective. We might describe that state without reference to how things look from the viewpoint of someone in that state. Or we might describe how someone in that state experiences and views things from the internal perspective. And only the second kind of description is a comment on the content of the ethical outlook. And a prominent aspect of the content of her outlook may be described as a sense of union, a sense of coming together as one with other humans and things. That sentiment has two dimensions, disappearance of oneself and incorporating others into oneself. These can be illustrated again with the example of anger and one body. Consider someone responding with the idealized form of anger. She acknowledges a situation in which she herself has been wrongfully injured, but she sees it as not different in nature from a situation in which someone else has been similarly injured. She recognizes that the response of anger comes from her, but she sees it as not different in nature from her responses to someone else being injured, or the response of someone else to her being injured. Speaking from our perspective, but commenting on her perspective, there is a sense in which she has let go of herself. As ordinary human beings, we and she, prior to her transformation, tend to ascribe a special significance to ourselves. In terms of this conception of an emphatic self, it appears as if she herself has disappeared from her view. Turning to the idea of one body, it idealizes a state in which one sees oneself as connected to others. The sentiment is modeled on that of a parent who sees her child as connected to her, like a single body being divided into two. So again, commenting from our perspective on the perspective of someone in that state, it is as if she has incorporated others into herself through the broadening scope of her sense of connectedness. This point is put by an 11th century Confucian in terms of enlarging one's heart so that not a single thing is not part of oneself. So these two dimensions, the disappearance of oneself and the incorporation of others into oneself, they are two complementary aspects of the sense of union that is part of the content of the ethical outlook. My presentation today gives only a general sketch of ideas, an overview of a larger project that will take several more years to complete. But I hope it illustrates the methodological point I made earlier. I propose an approach to the philosophical study of Confucian thought that involves a move from philology to philosophy. We do not start by asking how it addresses familiar philosophical questions, or by trying to fit its ideas into familiar philosophical categories. Instead, We start from inside the tradition, closely studying the language and the text, and taking into account the historical context. Having extracted the ideas through philological studies, we attend to the life experiences that the ideas reflect, experiences that transcend the local and the temporal, and that we can resonate with. Only then do we engage in further reflective work with these ideas, moving outward from the tradition and bringing these ideas in contact with contemporary philosophical discourse. There are other approaches that suit other purpose. The philological starting point is not needed if our goal is primarily to promote interest in the tradition or to gain some stimulation for our own philosophical reflections, independently of whether we accurately represent the tradition. But it will be crucial if the goal is to understand the tradition on its own terms, in moving from philology to philosophy, or from the inside out. We ensure that our philosophical reflections on that tradition are maximally continuous with the tradition itself. I have presented a sketch of some conclusions that result from this approach using relatively plain language. For reasons explained earlier, I have deliberately avoided invoking contemporary philosophical conceptions, such as the distinction between first and third person perspectives. What I hope to have shown is that without looking at Confucian thought through the lens of our familiar philosophical agendas and conceptions, there can still be interesting points of contact. The common ground with contemporary philosophical discourse has to do with human experiences of significance that transcend the local and the temporal. How to respond to wrongful injury and how to cope with loss and deprivation are concerns that we also share. The special sensitivity to harm that comes with special close relationships or the special accountability due to official positions are familiar phenomena. Highlighting the Confucian perspective on these concerns and phenomena helps bring to light alternative perspectives on familiar subject matters such as anger, compassion. It also helps bring into focus subject matters not currently at the center of contemporary philosophical agendas, such as acceptance and detachment, or the ethical relevance of attention and the idea of an ethical outlook. Thank you.